Oh, hey, it's Dave from before. Dave Hill from Show Business. And this week on The Novelizers, from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert and Conan, Brian Stack. From Succession and Reno 911, Mary Birdsong. Plus writer Liz Lent. They don't make podcasts like this anymore, I tell ya. Welcome to The Novelizers. This week's show is too good to be put into English words, which is why my dog is growling in the background.
Even your dog realizes that this is an incredible episode.
She's freaking out.
You need to take care of that.
No, she's protecting people from other podcasts.
Good.
Thank you, Lucy.
Of course, this is The Novelizers, the show where we take award-winning comedy writers turn classic films into hilarious audiobooks narrated by your favorite celebrities and actors and comedians. This season, we're doing Dark Knight. And what's happening in this, may I ask you, Dave, what are we covering?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen. This week, Alfred patches Bruce up. We meet Harvey and Rachel at the trial of mob boss Salvatore Moroni. An attempt is made on Harvey's life, which he handles gracefully. Harvey and Gordon meet. Gordon denies Batman's existence. Harvey is reluctant but decides to back Gordon's investigation into a couple different banks. In short, it has pretty much everything.
A gritty world. And who, tell me, pray tell, who's helping tell this story this week on the show?
I'm glad you asked, Stephen. Mary Birdsong is a friend of mine, of course, and also an actor and writer known for Reno 911, Succession, and more. Brian Stack, who I'm also friends with, as long as we're on the topic, is a writer and performer known for his extensive work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, as well as Conan. Liz Lent, whom I don't believe I've ever met, but I would be thrilled to, is a comedy writer and artist.
What an amazing lineup. Mary Birdsong, novelize us.
Chapter 3. Omniscient narrator says what? Novelized by Liz Lent. Narrated by Mary Birdsong. The sun rises over the skyline of Gotham City, a metropolis that in no way, no matter what you've heard, has any sort of problem with being fictional. This is a confident city, a brash city even. It feels totally unbothered and 100% secure about the fact that it is a made-up comic book construct. It does not ever watch with burning jealousy as Marvel superheroes fight crime and intergalactic villainy in real cities like New York, while Gotham City just sits there, filled with big fat lies, getting treated quite rudely at the annual City's Crawling with Villains and Monsters convention every March. Gotham City is forced every goddamn year to sit at the table at the back, right by the bathroom, shoulder to shoulder with Westeros and South Park. Neither of which bothers shower and are constantly eating with their hands. Anyway, Gotham City is totally fine being fake and never ever cries itself to sleep, except on its birthday. How do I know all this about Gotham City? How do I know its deepest, darkest secrets, its PIN number, its weight, its unfortunate history of cocaine use? Because I'm the omniscient narrator, bucko. I know everything about this city and everyone who lives within its sorry, fakey, fake boundaries. Want to know the penguin's shoe size? Trick question. He doesn't wear shoes. He wears bespoke slippers because they rhyme with flippers. Want to know whatever happened to Robin? That underage sidekick that no one ever talks about who disappeared without a trace, leaving nothing but rumpled bedsheets and stale cigarettes in his wake? Funny story. He actually went to Yale to study drama. He's doing great. Thanks for asking. And do you want to know what Alfred the butler is thinking when he walks into Bruce Wayne's pristine penthouse bedroom at the beginning of this scene? Sure you do. He's thinking what he thinks every morning when he brings Bruce Wayne breakfast in his pristine penthouse bedroom. He's thinking, please, Lord, please don't let me see his penis again. Just not today. Because Alfred has seen it so many times by now. It haunts his dreams. It's bruised his soul. Today, though, thankfully, Alfred is able to breathe a sigh of relief. There is no penis. There is also no Bruce. It would be weird the other way around. Anyway, Alfred stuffs Bruce's eggs, toast, and crystal orange juice goblet into his fancy butler pockets and heads over to Bruce's secret lair, which is craftily concealed in a rusty old shipping container that no one would ever guess contains an elevator and a big white basement with a sulky, sexy billionaire in it. The room is so ginormous that it takes Alfred like 6 minutes to cross it. He's panting like a dog and hunched over, clutching the stitch in his side. Fuck! I'm getting old, he thinks. He gasps out a little joke. I look forward to Wayne Manor being repaired so you can swap. Ooh, I really cannot breathe. Not sleeping in a penthouse with not sleeping. Oh my God, I'm so dizzy. In a mansion. Alfred lays down. He just needs a minute to recover. When he finally sits up, Alfred notices Bruce giving himself stitches, because why not, I guess? You're a billionaire with top-tier health insurance, and you can probably afford your own surgeon, but sure, go ahead and give yourself stitches. I'm telling you right now, though, as your omniscient narrator, it's gonna be uneven, and it's gonna look terrible when you've got your shirt off eating an ice cream cone and scaring children. Even Alfred is grossed out by what's happening here. He asks Bruce if he was bitten by a tiger. Bruce says, no, it was a big dog, orange with stripes. Alfred is suddenly unsure if Bruce knows what a dog is. Bruce tells Alfred that his armor was too heavy the night before and he hadn't been able to jump out of the way of the bad guys. Alfred tells him that's Mr. Fox's problem to solve. He's just delivering breakfasts and British gravitas. Bruce tells Alfred about all of the copycats at the crime scene the night before. You should hire them, Alfred says, and take a few days off. That's the best Michael Caine I can do. That's not what I had in mind when I said I wanted to inspire people, Bruce says. What he really had in mind was inspiring a group of gravelly-voiced kids to create a boy band dressed in all black with pointy ears and singing basso profundo range songs on the ledges of tall buildings. So far, to his knowledge, that has not yet happened. Alfred tells him not to be such a negative Nancy and to just look at the new district attorney if he wants to add a little sunshine to his day. Bruce has plenty of sunshine because he's already got surveillance videos of the new DA, who goes by the name of Harvey Dent. Bruce and Alfred agree that aside from the fact that Harvey is having tons of sex with Bruce's ex-girlfriend Rachel, he seems like a stand-up kind of guy. They watch more surveillance of Harvey until Alfred starts to get uncomfortable and says, ha ha, I hope you don't have me followed on my day off, when I shower and such. There is nothing but silence. A long, unending silence that says too much. Alfred knows the answer. He wishes he'd never asked the question. Bruce has finished sewing up his tiger bite. Dog bite. And is changing into a crisp white T-shirt. It's almost symbolic, this color change. What could it mean? Black, then white. Good guy, bad guy, big fan of Oreo cookies? No one knows. But it feels significant. Alfred warns Bruce to know your limits. Bruce drops his voice down another 3 octaves to the point where only dog tigers, Alfred, who's used to this stuff, and your omniscient narrator can hear it. Batman has no limits, Bruce growls, and he can't afford to know them. What happens when you find out? Alfred asks. We all know how much you like to say, I told you so, Bruce says. This is 100% true about Alfred. He barely has any friends. On that day, even I won't want to. Probably. Alfred says this, knowing full well he will not be able to resist pounding on the bat coffin and shouting, I told you so! The day this happens. He's just that kind of person. Luckily, before the sexual tension gets too raw in the Batcave, we now find ourselves in a packed Gotham City courtroom. It's all dark, polished wood, somber intentions, and big-shouldered suits, just like on Night Court. On the bad guy's side of the room sits a smoldering but shady mob boss named Salvatore Moroni, who is on trial for being a bad fellow. On the good guy's side of the room is Rachel, Batman's ex, who is anxiously watching the door. We soon learn she's been awaiting the arrival of Harvey Dent. Tall, blonde, with a head that looks like it's just a bunch of jumbled squares and jawlines. He looks better in color than he does in the grainy black-and-white surveillance videos that pervy Bruce Wayne has been stockpiling on him. Harvey apologizes for being late and slides into the seat next to Rachel, who asks him where he's been. He asks if she was worried that she'd have to step in for him, and she proudly announces she knows his briefs. I'm sorry, the briefs. Backwards and forwards. No jokes are made on screen about the briefs. Instead, Harvey just says, "Well then, fair's fair." And even I, the omniscient narrator, have no clue what that means. It's been bothering me. Like, a lot. But I'm trying to teach myself to let go more these days, so let's just move on. Harvey then shows Rachel a coin, mostly to establish it as a prop for future use in the movie, but also to get her to flip for who's going to plead the case that day, him or her. "Heads, I take it. Tails, it's all yours," Harvey says. Rachel, who apparently read all the law books, notes that it's probably not a great idea to base an important criminal prosecution on a coin toss. Harvey provides further exposition by saying it's his father's lucky coin. And I want to know how long these two have been dating, that this is the first time she's seen this damn coin he's so obsessed with. My guess is he drags that thing out at least twice, three times a day. Is he going to have a sub sandwich or a panini? Coin toss. Is he going to grow a mustache or mutton chops? Coin toss. Is he going to pay his taxes or hide them in an offshore account? Absolutely a coin toss. While Rachel and Harvey are being cute about the coin, the judge enters and everyone stands up. The judge sees Harvey with the coin and just rolls his eyes like, "Again with the coin, Dent!" He's definitely going to rule against him. The guy is so goddamn annoying. Harvey apparently decides to fulfill his duties as prosecutor and is now interrogating a witness who is giving off very hostile vibes. Harvey says, "With Carmine Falcone in Arkham, someone must have stepped up to run the family. Is that man in the courtroom today?" Salvatore has a big smile on his face, and we soon find out why, because the guy on the stand says, "Yes, it was me!" Dun-dun-dun! Harvey, who's been staring at Salvatore this whole time, whips around, shocked. That's not how it was supposed to go down. The guy on the stand had given him a sworn statement that the new head of the Falcone crime family was Salvatore himself, the guy on trial, sitting right there in the bad guy seat. Harvey's day is tanking fast. The witness keeps talking, saying Salvatore is a fall guy and he, witness guy, is the real brains of the organization. This makes everyone in the room laugh and laugh, because look at that guy. He doesn't have brains. He's just got an empty vessel on his shoulders upon which he rests fancy hats from time to time. Harvey asks the judge if he can treat the witness as hostile, which unfortunately was the setup line the witness was waiting for. The guy pulls a gun and shouts, "Hostile? I'll show you hostile!" He tries to shoot, but the gun malfunctions, giving Harvey plenty of time to wrestle the weapon out of the guy's hand and punch him in the face just for added saltiness. The guards wrestle the mean witness to the ground as Harvey takes the cartridge out of the gun and walks over to Salvatore, waving it in his face. "Carbon fiber, .28 caliber, made in China," Harvey says. The gun looks exactly like the one Harvey keeps hidden in the cleft of his chin. It smells like Triscuits in there. No one knows why. Harvey continues to taunt Salvatore, saying, "If you want to kill a public servant, Mr. Moroni, I suggest you buy American." Which is really just a sad commentary on the state of gun control in this country, but I think Harvey meant it more as a tough guy burn. He's not very nuanced. Outside the courtroom, he and Rachel are striding purposefully down a sun-dappled hallway. Harvey is waiting for her to express some sort of human emotion over his near demise. But she's a tough cookie, this Rachel, and probably doesn't even really like him, and just sees him as a rebound from her cool ex-boyfriend who can fly and is a billionaire. Rachel continues to talk about the case, noting that they'll never be able to match the gun to Moroni or even charge him.
But the fact that they're trying to kill you means we're getting to them, she says with unfettered and frankly inappropriate glee. She's not even trying anymore.
I'm glad you're so pleased, Rachel, Harvey says, adding that he's fine, by the way.
She reminds him that as Gotham's DA, if he's not getting shot at, then he's not doing his job right. The look in his eyes says she's hoping he does his job even righter in the future. She wonders what Bruce is doing right now.
Harvey mentions that he's about to go meet the head of the major crimes unit, Jim Gordon.
Rachel perks up and name drops, noting that Jim is a friend. Try to be nice.
Yes, Rachel, we get it. You know everybody. Jeez.
Harvey is not at all nice when he strides, all tall-legged and giraffe-y, into his office where Officer Gordon has been waiting. He just walks past him with not even a hello, or the offer of a fresh cup of coffee, or the sharing of a glazed jelly donut. To be fair, perhaps he didn't recognize Gordon because of the insanely huge mustache commanding all the real estate below the guy's nose. This thing is huge. It looks like it was ripped from the prone body of a Muppet. It's like if Ted Lasso had gotten sad, stopped grooming, slathered it in minoxidil, and donated it to science. And by science, I mean Jim Gordon. Harvey's office is expansive, filled with seemingly thousands of files and three guys from a 1982 JCPenney's catalog just standing around being awkward. Speaking of awkward, Gordon tries to warm up the room and tells Harvey,
I hear you've got a hell of a right cross.
And frankly, it's nice of him to even offer a compliment, given how rude Harvey is being, but Harvey just sighs and sits down. Gordon tries again to start a conversation.
It's a shame Sal's going to walk, he says.
Oh my God, he thinks. This is like pulling teeth. No wonder Rachel hates this guy. Harvey finally fucking speaks.
Yeah, well, the thing about the mob is they keep giving you second chances.
He looks down at a stack of money on his desk and says, lightly irradiated bills.
Fancy stuff for a city cop. Have help?
Gordon looks mildly shocked and makes up some stuff that amounts to, Batman had nothing to do with this or anything else we do. I have no idea who Batman is. I'm not even sure what a bat is. Is it a duck or a bear? What is man? What is life? Does the universe have meaning? Does this mustache make me look fat? Am I talking out loud?
Rude Harvey just says, save it, Gordon. I want to meet him.
Gordon calms down and says, official policy is to arrest the vigilante known as Batman on sight. Harvey wonders why he ever talked to this guy in the first place. He should have just let him ask increasingly desperate questions and stared at him until he started to cry. He's done it before to lesser men, like his mother. Harvey and Gordon go back and forth about who knows Batman and who gets invited to Batman's birthday parties and who gets to try on his bat ears until finally Harvey calls BS on the plan that Gordon and Batman have obviously hatched together to bring the Gotham City mob down by going after their money. Gordon wants Harvey's help with the scheme. Harvey tells Gordon he doesn't like him having his own special unit.
Unit.
And especially doesn't like it that it's staffed by cops he thinks are shady. But collapsing under the strength and power of Gordon's extraordinary hyper-masculine mustache, Harvey agrees to issue search and seizure warrants on five banks so Gordon can carry out his fancy plans. Gordon thanks him and says,
we all know you're Gotham's white knight,
which he sort of says like it's both a compliment and an insult, and I fear this is going to throw a wrench in their budding bromance just when they're starting to get close. Close enough for Harvey to touch that mustache. He really wants to. Like right now. He's going to be thinking about it all day. And so am I. On a related note, can omniscient narrators get tattoos? Just something bristly and tasteful.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell. Fast. To our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This That's the sound of your closet working for you. The Real Real. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
That was incredible.
Amazing. Of course, every week on the podcast, we talk to someone who worked on the film The Dark Knight. I don't know how we get them all, but we do. Let's hear that interview.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the interview portion of The Novelizers. I am Kevin Carter, and I'm here with a special person today. His name is Cecil Pinsky, and he is the, I guess for lack of a better term of the title, the Shiner for the Batman Dark Knight movie that came out in 2008. Hey, Cecil, how's it going today?
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm pretty sure I butchered the hell out of your title. Could you please let us know what it is you do?
Well, my job, first of all, thank you for having me. I rarely get to speak with others. My job on The Dark Knight, purely as a volunteer, was to shine everything, to shine the Batmobile, or what they called the Batmobile Tumbler, and Christian Bale's suit and his helmet and Michael Caine's shoes and Aaron Eckhart when he became Two-Face. I had to make sure that the deformed part of his face was shiny for maximum impact. So keeping everything shiny on set was basically my job. I offered to do it. I was not a hired position that I interviewed for. I was a retired piano teacher in Chicago when they were filming, and I offered to just be on set and keep everything shiny. And I think at first they were just trying to be polite by letting me hang around. But eventually I think they came to appreciate my craftsmanship.
So when you, and just to make sure the listeners know, when you say shiny, you're talking about you got like some spit and you're shining the suits and physically, and it's not just light you're shining on them, but you're shining like actually making them polish and things like that, correct?
Yes, I had done some shoe shining as a youth many years ago, before I worked on the railroad and was a piano teacher. But I used some of the skills I'd learned as a child, and also in the military. I was briefly in the Merchant Marine, and we had to keep our shoes nice and shiny. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, who needs to be shinier than Batman? And his Batmobile for the lights at night to gleam off of it properly, you needed to be extra shiny. Dust could interfere with its glory.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? This movie has been considered one of the best Batman, if not one of the best DC comic movies ever. Right. And I think a lot of it may has to do with what you were able to do, because everybody remembers Christian Bale's Batman. Everybody remembers the Batmobile with the big wheels, the tumbler, you know, and everything like that. It's interesting to hear you, you know, talk about that, because do you realize how big of an impact that movie is?
It's a wonderful film. It has a melancholy to it that I appreciate as someone prone to depression for both chemical and situational reasons. I find the darkness of the film comforting in a way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I find the complexity of Batman and his backstory really compelling.
When they came to you for this opportunity, were you already aware of who Christian Bale was, like the whole Batman series thing? Or were you just, because you seem, to me, it seems like you've had a very, very interesting life. Just on the 3 minutes we've talked, you've been working on railroads, you've been in the war, like you've done a lot.
At first, to be honest, too, when I saw the signs for The Dark Knight, I thought it was a medieval epic of some kind. Mm-hmm. That might be, I've always loved knights in shining armor. I've always wished the days of chivalry could return. But once I realized it was Batman, I found that equally intriguing, as I had watched the Adam West television show with Boom Pow and Burgess Meredith in a peerless performance as the Penguin. But I, once I realized it was Batman, I was just as interested, and I asked, "Is there anything here I could shine?" And they at first they were a little puzzled and thought maybe I wasn't all there. Someone actually said that to me verbatim. But I wandered onto the set, and someone offered me some craft services, thinking I might be hungry. I'm rather frail. And eventually when I offered to shine things, they said, "Well, why not? You know, sure, keep things shiny." And so I would walk up to Christian Bale if I saw any dust and just try not to get in his way or bother him or interfere mm-hmm. with his process, as actors call it. So I would just wipe down his suit and wipe any dust off, trying not to bother him. Mm-hmm. We never made eye contact during the entire filming.
So you he never looked you in the eye. Did you shine the suit while he was wearing it? That's the question.
I did. I shined it only while he was wearing it.
Okay.
They didn't allow me in after hours, so I would only shine it while he was there. And when he did notice me there, he seemed mildly annoyed, as most people are around me, quite frankly. But I think he came to appreciate that I wasn't doing any harm or mm-hmm. getting in his way. Mm-hmm. And eventually he tolerated my presence.
Okay, that's cool. And I think it's very interesting that they didn't even let you, you know what I'm saying, do it after hours, as if they didn't trust you, you know? And you seem like a very trustworthy guy, so I don't know why that would be the case.
Thank my you. Question, they may have Googled me.
Okay.
There are some things in my past I'm not entirely proud of. Some of the accusations are unfounded. Others are quite founded. But I'll be honest. I took from a charity cash box when I was in the Merchant Marine one time. I wanted to buy my best girl some flowers, and I was a little short on the old simoleons. So I took the box, got $14, and 6 months at Leavenworth.
How old are you? And I ask that because the way you speak is as if you were a child in the 20s. And I'm just trying to make sure, you know, same for age purposes.
I'm 95 years old. I was retired when The Dark Knight was filmed.
Gotcha.
And I would wander the streets, sometimes just looking for people to talk to. And that's when I saw the signs that they were filming it. Wandered onto the set, and the rest is history.
You stated earlier that you didn't get paid for this job. Why would you choose to do something of this magnitude and not get any money for it?
Well, it almost felt unfair to ask for money for such a life-enriching experience. I would say the same thing about other jobs I've had. I'll be honest with you, since I'm old, it doesn't really matter anymore. I was a paid assassin briefly and did that on a volunteer basis as well. I took out a couple of low-level mobsters who, frankly, didn't consider me a threat.
But I hear what you're saying, and I don't want to get your information out and people that may be wanting revenge.
At this point, I welcome the sweet embrace of the grave. Also, you know, the interesting thing, when I was briefly an assassin, the wonderful thing about being a kind of a frail, unthreatening presence is that people aren't nervous when you approach them. So mm-hmm. I was actually able to just drop a hand grenade in their lap. I was as surprised as anyone. I'm maybe not as surprised as they were.
Yeah. It's very interesting because I as I'm hearing it, I'm thinking to myself of the actual idea of dropping a hand grenade in someone's lap, to where it's like they had to watch you grab the grenade, pull the pin out, and then gently drop, I'm assuming it's gently drop it into their lap before they did anything, which is means you're in a very amazing assassin at that point.
Thank you, Kevin. It was interesting. The reaction was usually a mix of bewilderment and incredulity. They would stare at it as if this can't really be happening, can it? And Maybe in the middle of that thought, they blew up.
Yeah, that would make sense. Because I would probably pause and try to process everything before I made a move. So that makes sense to me. Question for you. What was life after the Batman movie? You know, because if I'm being honest, you know, nobody knew you did that. So you didn't really like have the fame, the notoriety or anything like that. How was life after the movie?
It was, well, I kind of returned back to normal. I had hoped I would get to do some shining on The Dark Knight Rises, but they must have lost my number. I repeatedly told them my number. Maybe the fact that I don't have email was getting in the way. But I did offer to shine on other superhero films, although there aren't many filmed in Chicago, which is why I did offer to shine on Chicago Fire, the set of Chicago Fire and Chicago PD and Chicago Med. But they seem to prefer to let their wardrobe people do all the shining.
And I mean, if I'm being honest, that's probably the way it is normally. And I think you were like a lightning in a bottle. You just got just that one opportunity and you made the best of it, which was good. Just a few personal questions, if you don't mind. Do you have any kids or anything like that?
I have one half brother. And children, I did briefly enter into the Big Brother program.
Okay.
Where I would take kids out on the weekends. And usually they would come out to the park with me. And then when I was distracted, they would wander off and leave me alone in the park. I'm sorry. That's another sad story.
Yeah. I think the issue here, Cecil, is I think you're forcing the sadness. Right. Let me ask you a question. What is if you could think back in your life, your amazing life, by the way, what's a bright spot in your life that you can think about? Like, you know what? That actually makes me happy.
I saw a free screening of Singing in the Rain at the library once.
Isn't that movie about like Nazis and stuff?
No, Singing in the Rain. It's about the time where silent films moved into talkies. It was with Gene Kelly.
Yes.
And it was a very wonderful film that I saw in the afternoon on a rainy day at the Arlington Heights Public Library in suburban Chicago. And it was, that was a pretty good afternoon.
That's good. I think I'm thinking of Sound of Music. I think I'm thinking
of, yes.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that did have Nazis.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. I think of a musical.
If Singing in the Rain had Nazis, it wouldn't have been entirely ruined, but Gene Kelly could dance right over those Nazis.
I've never seen his face, but I've heard of Gene Kelly, and seems like a nice guy. Seems like a guy that could use some nice shining if you were around for that.
Oh, if only I could have shined him.
Yeah.
It would have been a wonderful experience. Or Debbie Reynolds, or Donald O'Connor, or any of the other wonderful performers in the golden age of Hollywood.
Cecil, you see what's happening right now? You're starting to speak of life and fun. You're starting to be happy right now. It's not sad right now.
You're right, Kevin. And becoming aware of how rare that is sad in and of itself. But it's still a bright spot.
Yeah, exactly. It's still a bright spot.
No, it's still, you're right. There is joy to be found in life, and I do find it on a daily basis in the eyes of a passing child whose parents are telling them not to look at me, or a pigeon coming towards me to get some breadcrumbs. You know, there is a lot of, there is little moments of joy in life. You're right, Kevin. Thank you for reminding me of that.
And that's what I'm here for. Like, I tell people all the time when I interview people, this is more than just an interview. This is a relationship building session right now, you know, because I see more in people than just their jobs and stuff.
Thank you. Thank you for looking beyond the obvious.
Not a problem. Not a problem. Cecil, I want to thank you for joining us for a great interview today. I believe you are going to get more job opportunities, gain more fans, because you have a life and have a personality that people would just love to be around.
Thank you, Kevin. That means a lot. If you ever need anything shined and you're in Chicago or want to spring for a bus ticket to let me come to you and shine you there, shine things around your apartment, shine your shirt or your headphones, whatever it may be, I'm ready to, I'd love to hang out.
I'll have my people, you know, send email your people, you know, if that's okay.
Sure. You're looking at my people. Just me.
Okay.
Not one peep. But please let me know. I'd love to, you know, meet up. Maybe I could show you Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, I would love to see Gene Kelly. That'd be a nice one.
You could tell me where the Nazis might have improved things.
That'd be great. That'd be great, Cecil. All right, everybody. Thank you for enjoying this interview portion of The Novelizers.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Brian Stack. That's our show for tonight. I don't think I can sleep tonight after listening to that incredible show.
No, I may never sleep again.
Ever.
Well, thanks for listening, person listening right now. And also, thanks to this week's guests, Mary Birdsong, Brian Stack, and Liz Lent.
Good night, everybody.
My dog looked at me after I made that explosion sound.
Just making sure you're all right, protecting you from the explosion.
The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, with Stephen Levinson, and produced by Stephen, Dennis DiClaudio, Cole Emhoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Rob Kuttner, and Marla Ratner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Editing and mixing by Graham Douglas. Music by Cole Emhoff. Theme song by Andrew Lynn. Special thanks to Brad Combs and Parabolic Studio in Manhattan. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is written and recorded without the use of AI. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers, LLC.